This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks to Galileo, we all know that the Earth orbits the Sun. But did you know that the Sun, and in fact our entire solar system, is orbiting around a massive black hole at the center of the galaxy? A small group of science enthusiasts thinks we should all stop and ponder this and other amazing facts about our place in the universe once in a while, and they've declared a holiday this Thursday for exactly that purpose. It's called Galactic Tick Day. You'll hear why later this hour. You'll also hear about efforts to turn old offshore oil rigs into artificial reefs that are home to a diversity of marine life. But before we get to any of that, we're going to talk about household dust. If you're anything like me, it's probably not your favorite topic, maybe even a little bit of a touchy subject. It turns out there's more reason than you probably knew to try to cut down on dust. A new study suggests that the vast majority of household dust contains potentially toxic chemicals that come from everyday items like our furniture and pots and pans. Robin Dodson is an environmental exposure scientist at Silent Spring Institute. She's one of the authors of a new study, which was published in Environmental Science and Technology. Robin, welcome back to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Now, why is household dust such a likely place to find potentially toxic chemicals?
Well, household dust kind of acts as a reservoir for where contaminants inside the home can find their way, and they just kind of stay put. So we talk about it as a reservoir. It's really kind of a picture, even a snapshot, of what the contamination or the pollutant load might be in the home.
When we're looking at chemicals that are in dust, is the concern that people in the home might be ingesting the dust, breathing it in, and actually getting the chemicals from the dust? Or is it, as you say, simply a reflection of what's in our environment and what we might be exposed to in other ways?
Right. So I think it's kind of a little bit of both. So it's a great place to look. So that's where we typically do a lot of measurements. But those chemicals that actually find their way into the dust don't tend to stay there. We can actually directly ingest these chemicals as they're adhered to the dust. This is particularly an issue with children who spend a lot of time on the floor playing, putting things into their mouth. So the chemicals can find their way directly into their mouth, and then they ingest it. But the chemicals can actually also, they interact in the indoor environment, meaning that they can come off the dust, they volatilize off the dust and get into the air that we could breathe. And this air can actually also get on our skin and actually penetrate and go through our skin so that we can be exposed to what we call the dermal pathway as well.
So this new study that was recently published is not actually a new study in the sense that you went out and did a whole bunch of new measurements, but it's kind of looking at all the work that has been done so far. So how much data is there, and can you draw major conclusions from looking at the studies that were already available?
Sure. So exactly. This study is what we call a meta-analysis of the existing literature. So we looked at nearly all the published research on consumer product chemicals in the last 15 years or so. And we were focusing on 45 different consumer product chemicals. These chemicals, looking at the literature, we found that over 26 peer-reviewed studies that reported in some information about these chemicals, and we pulled all that data together to try to aggregate and to try to really get a picture of what the average or the typical exposures or levels in dust might be in U.S. homes.
I mean, 26 by some counts might be a big number, but 26 studies, 14 states, doesn't necessarily seem like we have that much information about toxic chemicals in dust.
I think a little bit of yes and no. I mean, here at Silent Spring Institute, we've been looking at household dust as an indicator of potential residential exposure for more than 15 years, starting way back when we did our Cape Cod household exposure study. So there are data sets like that. That's over 100 different homes that are in that study, for example. So when we talk about just 26 studies, you have to remember 26 studies, that means that there's many, many samples that might be in each of those studies. But it also, yeah, I mean, to a point that there is still a lot we don't know about these chemicals in our indoor environment, and including what the levels might really be in homes across the United States.
Now, one of the take-home messages from the study was that there were 10 potentially harmful chemicals that were found in the vast majority of samples, 90% of household dust. Give us a sense of what those chemicals are and where they're coming from.
Yeah, sure. So those chemicals, those top 10, they include chemicals that are part of a class of chemicals known as phthalates. So phthalates are chemicals that are typically added to plastics, including vinyl, or even personal care products. And those, I mean, every time I look for phthalates in people's homes, I detect them. And we found that that's to be true across all the studies that we looked at. They were found in nearly, you know, almost 100% of all the dust samples that were ever looked at. Another group of chemicals that are in that top 10 are flame retardant chemicals. And these include, actually, one of them is a carcinogenic flame retardant, meaning that it's been associated, at least in laboratory studies, with cancer. And when we look for that chemical or when others have looked for that chemical, we find that in 95 or 100% of dust samples that we look for. We also found a fragrance chemical very much pervasive in these samples. And this fragrance chemical is a HHCB, and it's been associated with different health effects, but I think what's most striking about that is that really, actually, there's a lack of information about the fragrance chemicals in general, and I just think this is almost kind of a peek into what the loading of these types of chemicals, these fragrance chemicals, might actually be in dust.
When you say fragrance, are you talking about perfume, cosmetics? Are these fragrances, you know, like the trash bags that are supposed to smell nice or in cleaners? What kind of fragrances are we talking about?
Yeah, so they're chemicals that are actually added to the products to impart some sort of smell. So yes, it certainly includes things like perfume or cologne that are intentionally meant to provide a scent to us, right? But it does include scented cleaning products, or it includes scented lotions or shampoos or things like that. There's, you know, thousands of chemicals that might actually act as these fragrance chemicals, and we know very little about them.
When you say that, you know, if you look, you find these chemicals, the phthalates and this fragrance chemical. I mean, our ability to find things has improved dramatically in recent years. How much of it are you finding? Are these really significant levels, or is this, you know, just very tiny traces?
Yeah, so I think we've certainly benefited from improvements in the analytical work in the last couple of years for some of these chemicals, phthalates, right? We're getting very good at measuring those. But I would say that, you know, even if you look at these levels and they seem kind of small, what you have to remember is that many of these chemicals have similar health endpoints, meaning that they can affect our bodies in similar ways. If it's affecting our thyroid system or affecting our reproductive development, and because many of them act in these similar ways in our body, you can imagine that you start adding that all up, and what leads to, so these small amounts may just add up to some sort of amplified health risk that we wouldn't have otherwise predicted if we're looking at, say, one chemical at a time.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Robin Dodson of Silent Spring Institute. We're talking about a new synthesis of research on toxic chemicals found in household dust. Robin, were you surprised when you looked at all of these data sets together at just how many chemicals were found in almost all household dust?
Well, I think in one sense I was not quite surprised. Since I've been doing this research for years, and we consistently find these chemicals in dust, but we needed to do this study because it provides kind of a comparison that we can use to try to inform policy or inform ways that we can kind of take action. So yes, as a researcher, I've had an inkling of that these chemicals are typically widespread in our homes, but nobody had really pulled that data together to try to demonstrate it, and then so this tool, this kind of demonstration, can be then used to inform policy, manufacturers, or even just individuals to try to take action.
You said earlier that dust is both a reflection of the environment and a possible pathway for these chemicals to get into our bodies. I wonder if perhaps the more important question is, are these chemicals in our bodies, and how much do we know about that?
Yeah, so one thing that we tried to do to try to contextualize these results for that exact reason is, okay, you tell me that these chemicals are in dust, but do they actually get in me? What we actually did is we tried to model that. We took these average concentrations that we had determined from the literature, and we applied a model to them that actually estimates how much can actually get into our body. And we did that actually for children, Since children in particular, not only from a health perspective, we're concerned about them because they might be more vulnerable to particular health effects, but also just because we know that they have higher exposure to dust itself. They just ingest more dust every day.
They roll around on the floor and they lick things.
The floor, and, right? They put things into their mouth a lot. And so we actually took the steps to do that, to provide the context of to demonstrate that, yes, these chemicals are not only in our dust, but we estimate by standard assumptions that these chemicals actually get into our bodies.
You mentioned one chemical in particular that, based on laboratory studies, is strongly associated with cancer, is called a carcinogen. But with this whole range of chemicals, maybe we could walk through some of the different classes of chemicals and what we really know about their health effects and how much we should be concerned about them. And maybe we could start with phthalates, since that's the one that was found most commonly. How strong is the evidence that these affect human health?
Right. So phthalates are associated with a variety of different health endpoints. What we did when we were associating these to different health endpoints, we actually looked at authoritative lists. So these are when the U.S., you know, EPA or the National Toxicology Program here in the United States has considered it or classified it, say, as a carcinogen. We're looking at those types of lists. We pulled that data together, and that's what we're actually trying to use to demonstrate whether or not they hit these endpoints. So phthalates actually are associated with several different health hazards, including reproductive issues with reproductive development, some associated with cancer, although not the data there isn't as strong. They're associated with hormone systems, immune systems, respiratory issues, things like that. So the evidence for phthalates is actually it's growing, and it's quite large so far. And phthalates, even some of these levels that we're finding are, what we call them, kind of environmental and health relevant, meaning they're at levels where researchers previously have shown or demonstrated a risk to children or others at these particular levels in homes. So phthalates kind of have the most kind of information about them because we have both data from animals as well as from humans as to their potential effects. The other chemical class that we didn't find at as high levels but are associated with a lot of these different health hazards are these fluorinated chemicals or perfluorinated chemicals. And they are associated with things like reproductive issues, cancer, immune system issues. And what's interesting there is that I think there's a lot still we don't know about those particular chemicals. There's a lot that we can still learn. These chemicals are typically found in treated products that are treated to impart some sort of stain resistance or water resistance. They're also found in things like nonstick pans or floss, dental floss, things like that. And those are a particular class of chemicals that I think are associated potentially with a lot of different health effects, but we need to understand more about our exposure to those chemicals. The other chemicals that we looked at were things like phenols, and that includes parabens, which are commonly found in personal care products. And those are more associated with alterations in our hormone system, particularly the female hormone system, the estrogen systems. And then we also had the flame-retardant chemicals. And those flame-retardant chemicals are associated with a wide range of health effects. I've already mentioned one that's considered a carcinogen. There's another one that we actually found fairly frequently that is also associated with cancer. But those are also associated with neurotoxicity. They affect our brain and our nervous system. And so while you can see, right, as I kind of walk through all these, that many of these chemicals have many different health endpoints, but each of them also may contribute to the same health effect, which adds to that increased risk.
Well, and as I'm listening to you list these off, first of all, first reaction is this is just an overwhelming list of chemicals coming from all sorts of different directions. But then specifically, as you were talking about the perfluorinated compounds, those, of course, have been in headlines in recent weeks because of their presence in drinking water, particularly in areas around like firefighter training facilities, because they're also in these flame retardant foams. I mean, it really starts to sound like we're just being barraged from all directions. Is there a way to try to get a handle on this and start to figure out maybe first steps, both in terms of research priorities, but also in terms of action priorities for those of us, you know, living in our homes and consuming these various products?
Right. So there are. I mean, so the research, fortunately, we are developing the research to try to demonstrate how to reduce our exposure to these chemicals. Now, one thing I want to kind of say up front is that it's likely because we're only looking at the exposure to these chemicals in dust and in air in our homes that we've likely underestimated the exposure to some of these chemicals. As you brought up, these perfluorinated chemicals are often found in some places in water. So water contaminated water may actually be the kind of dominant exposure pathway for some of these. Or things like phthalates are sometimes found or been more associated in some cases with diet. So we are potentially underestimating the true exposure, and unfortunately that means that the kind of the story gets even worse, unfortunately. But there are a couple things we can do. I don't want to kind of have people walk away throwing their hands up thinking there's nothing we can do. The first thing I think is we can just scrutinize a little bit more carefully the products that we actually bring into our homes. Is trying to actually keep these from even entering our homes can really, you know, reduce our exposure. And so here at Silent Spring Institute, we've actually developed a research-based app that has over 200 recommendations to try to reduce your exposures to these chemicals. So that includes things like washing your hands frequently, particularly for children. If these chemicals are found in dust and they've been playing on the floor and things like that, washing children's hands before they eat can significantly reduce their exposure to these chemicals. Also, things like vacuuming frequently with a strong vacuum fitted with a HEPA filter, which is a particulate filter. So these simple kind of steps can go a long way and should really empower the homeowner, the mom, the dad, to try to reduce their exposures in the home. But yes, I think this research also lends itself to not only identifying research priorities, so now we know the common mixtures of chemicals that we're finding in homes, and that can help us figure out what type of studies we should do from a health perspective or even just further exposure studies. But also we're hoping that these results will be influence the way regulators think about chemicals as well as manufacturers think about chemicals. This idea of identifying and thinking about safer substitutes. There's chemicals that could be substituted into these products that have a less worrisome health profile.
You mentioned vacuuming with a HEPA filter. Is that really the best way to clean up dust? Is dry dusting or wet dusting better? I mean, when it comes to actually cleaning your house, are there better ways to do it?
Well, I think certainly a strong vacuum with a HEPA filter has been demonstrated as a way to reduce the dust loading in our homes. But I also think using a damp cloth, I mean, that's what's been recommended for years when you think about lead exposure in homes, which is lead typically found in paint chips and dust and things like that, is actually using a damp cloth or a damp mop, it can be quite effective. But there's other things, too, in terms of, like, not, you know, carpeting as much, you know, keeping bare floors where the dust may be lower. It's not going to kind of grab onto the dust. And also things like taking shoes off before you come inside or putting a mat by the door can also reduce just the dust loading inside of your home.
We saw earlier this summer the passage of a new Toxic Substances Control Act at the federal level. Do you think that that law will make a positive difference? I mean, will actually make the products that we're buying off the shelves safer?
I'd say I'm hopeful. I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. You know, in that what that direction is actually where Europe has been for a long time. So this idea is let's think about the chemicals and try to understand their potential health harm before we actually put them into products. So it's certainly a step in the right direction in that respect. I think what we need to do now is actually support that program now. So because of that new law under TSCA, EPA has a big task ahead of them. And I think as researchers and even just as advocates or whoever you may be, supporting the EPA so that they can actually try to add teeth to this law and get something done under this new law is really what we need to focus on.
Many of the chemicals that you've talked about that are in dust that are of concern are things that can potentially act like hormones. They're known as endocrine disruptors. And researchers actually gathered at the National Institutes of Health last week to celebrate and discuss 25 years of research on endocrine disruptors in the environment. Clearly, we've made progress in being able to detect these, in studying them in the laboratory. There was a lot of skepticism, I think, public skepticism in the early years about whether or not this was even something we need to be concerned about. Do you think we've made progress in terms of awareness and concern about endocrine disruptors?
I think so. I mean, I think that there's more that we can learn, but I think researchers like those of us here at Silent Spring Institute that have been studying these endocrine disruptors for 20 years, we have made progress in shedding a light on these potential issues, these chemicals that, you know, it's not a obvious or overt health effect that you're seeing when you're exposed to these chemicals. Rather, it's kind of a more subtle kind of long-term health effect, and things like breast cancer. That's what we spend a lot of time thinking about. So I think the idea of kind of our kind of persistence of looking at these issues and looking at these exposures in homes in particular has shed a light on it. And I'm hopeful that we can kind of continue to do this kind of work, both to demonstrate exposure as well as the potential health effects associated with these chemicals as we move forward.
That's Robin Dodson, an environmental exposure scientist at Silent Spring Institute, and one of the authors of a recent study showing that potentially toxic chemicals are surprisingly common in household dust. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Next, we turn to efforts to turn old offshore oil rigs into artificial reefs with both ecological and economic benefits. That's coming up when Living Lab continues after a short break.